Good evening, everybody. I'm John Boy, and it's a couple of minutes past 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, wet Tuesday afternoon here in Apollo Bay. You're in the Book Show, and on 87.6 FM dial tonight we have Dennis. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, John. Thank you.
There is a little bit of a change of the schedule plan. The anarchists who've stuffed up our voting system has made it a little difficult for Lee Kelly to get here because she's had to count votes all day to get the country back up and running. So initially we'll probably be just talking about maybe scientific books, Dennis, is that... and Tim Flannery's, a few of his books, and you have something else to
chat
about?
We do, yes. We could also have a little look at what David Suzuki has done, because Tim Flannery, in a lot of ways, is a continuation of the movement that David got started.
Yeah, that's right, and he's written quite a few books. I sort of Googled Tim Flannery. You were mainly going to speak about the Weathermakers, but I didn't realise he'd written so many books on varying, mainly scientific subjects, and his latest one was Atmosphere of Hope, that came out last year. Is that right?
Yeah, it's looking for solutions to global warming, assuming that you do believe global warming is real. Yeah. Basically, the case for that is if you were alive in the 1840s, there was 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and now, for the first time, there is over 400. So this year, Cape Grim in Tasmania will detect a part per million ratio of carbon dioxide of over 400.
What are you trying to tell me, that it's real?
Yes, it's real. There's far more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the carbon dioxide locks heat in and affects the way that the water vapour in the atmosphere behaves.
But Dennis, one of our new senators that might get elected wants to call a royal commission into global science. This can't be right.
Have they got red hair?
I think so.
Oh, there you go.
On their head as well. Alan, welcome, Alan.
He's a man with no hair.
Man with no hair. Our other... scientific reporter?
Oh, very generous of you, John Boy. I have read a few books with science leanings, but I'm no scientist.
No. Well, this is, you don't have to be here. We are people who read books and like to discuss the pros and cons. You have read The Weathermakers?
I have, yeah. Yes. In fact, I just caught the end of what you were saying to Dennis. I've read several of Tim Flannery's books, but... you asked me for detail, I don't think I'll be able to give it to you.
Oh, that's all right.
But I'll be able to tell you probably what he's on about.
put aside, say for a moment, that it's about science, as a writer, I find a lot of sort of non-fiction books boring to read. Does Flannery, to get that message across in a book, you need to be able to grab the common man's attention, I suppose.
Yeah.
Do you think as a writer...
I know what you think, Dennis, but he's a storyteller.
Yeah.
Yeah, he writes a book for the layman. So anybody can pick up a Tim Flannery book and read it and take away something that'll stick.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking in particular of that book about North America, Dennis. What was that called?
It's called The Eternal Frontier.
Yeah, that's right, The Eternal Frontier. And, you know, the way he lays out the North American continent and explains why the weather has such an impact in North America because of the geography and the lay of the land, you know, you just go, oh, I get it.
Yeah,
I see what you're talking about, Tim. Yeah, I really would never have, you would never have thought of these concepts unless he lays them out.
Yeah, so would you call it like a scientific journal or...
Well, the thing about Tim that's perhaps a little different from David Suzuki is David was originally a geneticist. And in a couple of books of his I've read, I think they're a little more inaccessible unless you have some basic grounding in science. Like, his messages are still very strong.
Yeah.
But I would say they're perhaps not as readable. Tim was actually an arts graduate in his original degree. So he was from Sandringham and he went to La Trobe and got a Bachelor of Arts. And then after that, he... went to New South Wales and started his environmental studies up there.
Right, and he...
what I was sort of brought that up for, of course, was that makes him quite a good communicator. Like, he has that basis in reading and writing.
That's right, yeah. And I suppose that would be why his books are reasonably popular, because, you know, if you're writing for a scientist, it's a fairly narrow reading audience. Mm. Whereas, and to get his message across, if you can't, you know, gel, I suppose, with the common man, so to speak, or your average Australian citizen, whatever that might be, you're not going to get your message across.
No, that's right. And I think, I'm sure that he can write that scientific journal, John, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
For the science community, equally as he can write the novel, if you want to call it that, but it's not, they're not novels, of course. They're
Look, he's a very well-published zoologist. After his work in Sydney, he actually did a lot of work in New Guinea on speciation of marsupials, because in New Guinea you have all those very high mountains and very deep valleys, some of which apparently white people haven't gotten to yet. There's 600 languages in New Guinea, is that right?
Yeah.
And they've speciated in the same way, if you will. And so Tim went down into a lot of these inaccessible areas and wrote quite a string of scientific papers about how evolution had shaped the types of animals and plants you found in those communities.
And just as we were saying before, how he turns a story into the, so the layman can grasp, in that those very tomes that you're talking about, Dennis, that he described, and I think this is back in the early 80s, how the climate change, global warming, was affecting the higher altitudes of the mountains in New Guinea and allowing the mosquitoes to ascend the sides of the mountains, if you like, to mountain climb. Mm. And if you think back into those, the book that where he enunciated that, you think, it just lays it out. You think, yeah, well, there's an example where everybody can sort of relate to, oh, mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Geez, and they're breeding now in the alpine areas of New Guinea, you know.
Yeah.
And getting higher and higher.
Sounds good.
Well, yes, I know it's good, but what I'm trying to lay out is that he can strike that chord with you where he makes that connection.
Yeah. And, I mean, as a commentator, when you listen to him on radio telly, he does speak quite well, I think, to sort of people like us, I suppose.
Well,
as
Dennis said, he's a noted zoologist and was able to pick, I think, 7 of the 8 penises that they had on the menu
seven
in China.
What?
7 of the 8 penises that were on the menu when he did the China trip with...
That's right.
Come on, boys. The TV series.
Roy and HG.
And
whose penises were they, Alan?
Well, they were animals' penises, Dennis. Mm. And
always a good.
They were served up as delicacies.
Yeah, yeah. So he could identify.
And he was asked by Roy, a bit of a play on his role as a zoologist. What are these, Tim? And he was able to, I think, 7 of the 8. He was able to work out what they were.
Oh, that's always a good
sign. I'm not sure whether they ate 7 of 8.
Just another meat, I suppose. Yeah, sorry, Dennis.
Sounds like a footy trip, John.
It does, yes.
Now, moving on from that penis joke.
I thought would just divert you somewhat.
Yeah, just bring the tone down a tad. Yeah.
If we sort of had a look, say, The Eternal Frontier, which was a book about... as Alan has said, North America, that I think he wrote in the 90s. Would that be right, Al?
Yeah, well, it's
I'm
right there in front of you.
In front of it here. Let's see.
Just,
here we go. The Eternal Frontier.
Forget about using up energy to look up Mr. Google, mate. Just read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do something
I'll just
different.
Not off here. 2001. Yeah. So what he starts off looking at is what makes North America such an interesting place is that North America is a north-south continent, so it spans the whole world from north to south. Starts right up in the Arctic and goes right down to the Antarctic.
If the audience could see us, we're nodding.
Whereas Eurasia, which is where, well, we're from, is an east-west continent. It sort of stretches from Siberia right around to the point of Spain, even though the Europeans like to think they're not part of Asia.
They are.
And, well, I mean, England certainly isn't now.
Well, you can buy bread in Vietnam, mate. Are you sure about that?
That's right.
Not sure
French loaf.
Anyway, I
digress.
Yeah, so Tim basically looks at the creation of the American continent and, as Alan said, the way that is sculpted, the kinds of animals and plants that you find there. Particularly with North America, the meteorite impact that ended the rule of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago today, actually.
Wow.
Hit America in the Caribbean, made basically that big hole that the Caribbean islands are in. And that had worldwide effect. And he kind of looks at the way America has evolved since through the various ice ages and how the American fauna is quite unique and how it has contributed via its connection across the Bering Strait into Asia to a lot of the animals and plants we enjoy today. For example, if you patted your dog, the dog originally evolved in North America along with a horse and a few other things like that.
Yeah. And the way he tells that story, yeah, because he was, it's down at ground level when he tells the story.
Yeah.
You know, I'm standing in the crater, you know. And right, yeah, it's just amazing because I had no knowledge of this,
yeah,
meteorite until I read that book. And you know, what a significant event. You know, none of us can remember 65 million years ago, but it's there. The record's there. They can prove it inconclusively, or conclusively, I should say,
yeah,
that this happened and the dust settled in this way and the winds blew it this way and you, as a consequence, this happened and that like, happened. And
yeah,
yeah.
So what type of research would you need to, say, put a book together like that? You would just have to go through all the data, I suppose, it's research.
He's obviously a prolific reader. Tim apparently lives in a house on the Hawkesbury River that's only accessible by boat. So I guess that's how he fills in his time.
Yeah.
He doesn't own any power tools. He uses hand saws and God knows what. So he's practicing what he preaches a bit. But the thing about Tim's book, as Alan's saying, is probably people are aware of Tim basically as an environmental campaigner, but it's not a book that's preaching to you. It's a book that has a lot of different faces that you can identify with if you have a curious mind. And cool, so it's not a dull read.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reckon that's a good point, Dennis. A curious mind is the key here. Yeah. You don't have to be a person that's intimately interested in even natural history, but you just have a mind that, and open and ask questions. Well, why, as Julius Sundermüller used to say,
why is it so?
Why is it so?
We are still talking about, what's the name of that novel?
It's called The Eternal Frontier.
The Eternal Frontier.
The history of North America.
Right.
When I say history, complete history, not just human history.
Right. Yeah. Like I was saying before, to research a book as comprehensive or a work as comprehensive as that would take, I would have thought, a long, long time.
Mm.
And then to make it sort of interesting, probably take a bit longer.
Hmm.
You think?
I'm sure it would.
You might want to expand on that.
Yeah, could you expand on that?
Well, look, it'd take a long time to write. It's very thick. And the bibliography up the back is just huge. So obviously it involves a lot of reading. But then again, this is a very well-researched area.
Yeah.
So where Tim starts off basically is 65 million years ago when the meteorite struck, and it was a fairly large meteorite as they go. I think it was about a kilometre or so in diameter.
Now, if you're saying that's the one that supposedly killed the dinosaurs.
He's doubting.
Well, I didn't know that. I thought that was still a bit of conjecture, the fact that that might happen. I think the Baptists in America don't think that's what happened.
Well, that's probably the case, but if the way Flannery lays this out, it's if you're a believer in what Flannery's saying, you'll say, well, that's makes a lot
makes
of sense
a lot
to
of
me,
sense, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see exactly where you're coming from, and it's not a position he's just dreamed up, as you said, it's well researched in. Mm. You look at the bibliography.
Yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah, it was a nice little, you know, trying to draw us off somewhere else, John. But, you know, the far right haven't got us all yet, have they?
No. Well, they've had a crack and look what's happened.
Look what happened, yeah.
Look what happened.
Sorry, Dennis.
Yeah. That's all right. No, I was just going to put an asteroid strike into perspective. So, say, if you were maybe looking at an asteroid that was sort of, say, 2 kilometres wide, which doesn't sound a lot. That's less than the distance from here to my place. But if it was hitting the Earth, say, in a normal part of the ocean that's about 4,000 or 4 kilometres deep, it would actually sort of splash all of the water out of the way.
yeah,
if you like. So if you were positioned in the correct spot, you could see the seafloor as the meteorite drove into it. Because Earth is revolving around the sun very, very quickly, and meteorites come screaming in from outer space, the speed of contact, if you like, can be huge, say 50, 60,000 kilometres an hour, and the impact's devastating. And so most of the meteorite melts, if you like, and it completely fractures the Earth's crust. Enormous amount of heat is generated, and in the case of the American meteorite strike 65 million years ago today, it came in on an angle, so it doesn't come in straight down. So if you're a golfer, it left a huge divot.
Yeah,
it sprayed soil and rocks and everything all up over North America. So it sort of came screaming in, if you like, from the South American direction, hit, and there was an enormous ejector, which is dirt and all that crap flying up over the rest of America. That contributed to the wonderful soils that modern Americans have enjoyed.
Right,
And why my dad, I suppose, used to call it God's own country, because compared to Australia, it's a very, very fertile place. If you've ever sort of travelled there, it's not that much bigger than the Australian mainland, but it's certainly not like here. It's a very, very fertile, well-watered place.
Right.
If I could, I've just, while Dennis has been talking, I've actually just had a look into the book, and I might just read maybe one little bit of a snippet of a paragraph here, which would, and it'll give the readers an idea of the sort of language that he uses.
Yeah, for sure.
So he says, "The sea into which the great lump of rock splashed down was about 10 metres deep. I imagine it as being rather like the tropical seas of today, with their mixture of azures and luminous greens, and teeming with fish and other marine life. Only back then there were giant reptiles, rather than whales and dolphins and ammonites, a bit like nautiluses, but no reefs of coral like today. Instead, giant clams, some a metre long and shaped like the horns of cattle, others jammed together in enormous colonies, took their place." Now, you see the sort of language he's using?
Yeah.
You know, he called it the lump, the great lump of rock. So he doesn't even call it an asteroid or a meteorite. Or he just says, well, it's calls it for what it was.
What it was,
a rock.
A lump of rock, yeah. No, that's cool. Language.
So, yes, definitely. And the place that the asteroid hit, I mean, didn't look like North America today. Pangaea was still in existence, and what that meant basically was that all the world's modern continents were more or less squeezed up together at that time.
Yep.
And that subsequently separated into two halves, the bottom half being Gondwana, which was where Australia's heritage comes from. And it's also interesting to note, of course, that the marsupials that we identify with so much here in Australia actually evolved in North America as well, and travelled to Australia down through South America, across a land bridge into Antarctica, along through Antarctica, then up into Australia, while Australia was still attached to Antarctica back in these prehistoric times, 65 million years ago. So the world is a very changeable place when looked at over that amount of time.
It certainly is. It's hard to comprehend, really.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a big bang. No question about that.
But what I find interesting is, how do we know this? Like, the science that... Like, I find that just almost incomprehensible, the science that has obviously gone into leading to us to know that.
Yeah, well, the evolution of the marsupials is interesting because obviously there's been a lot of marsupial fossils dug up in Australia. There's some tremendous fossil beds, and what you're looking for is the oldest fossils, if you will. Generally, where an animal evolves is the largest amount of variation in that particular animal that you're looking at. But, of course, in the case of North America, marsupials have died out there. There's plenty of marsupials in South America, and there were plenty of marsupials in Antarctica before it got really cold down there and knocked them all off. And so Australia is an ark, but the Australian marsupial fauna has actually developed from only a few types of marsupial that were isolated here as Australia broke away from Antarctica and started drifting north.
Right. And that's all in that book.
Yeah.
And more. And more. And what you've done there, John, you've actually gone down the scientific line. The question you've asked, then has said to the person who wants to then interrogate what he's saying, needs then to go scientific, because that's how you do establish the reality or not, or and the impacts of these things through the scientific evidence.
Yeah.
And if I could, I might read you just one more little
passage.
Now, and this is the, he also gives the name of this impact, and I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's spelt C-H-I-C-X-U-L-U-B. It's something like Hixulub. Is that right, Dan?
That's very Mexican, Alan.
Well, yeah, it's something like that. So while the immediate effects of the Hixulub impact on North America are widely accepted by the scientific community, John Boy, there is less agreement upon the nature of these global medium-term consequences and how they affected the dinosaurs and other creatures. Recent research in North America points to a sudden extinction of the 8 families and 14 genera of dinosaurs, including such favourites as Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus, at about the time of the impact, rather than the gradual decline over millions of years that many earlier researchers believed had occurred. Okay, now to be able to say, well, how do they know that? This is where you've got to go into the literature and work out, well, how did he get that?
Yeah, yeah.
Where did he come to that point? Which you don't have to do. If you want to read his stuff, as we said before, you can go along with him and just say, well, I, you know, you've done all the work and you know what you're talking about. I'm not pretty happy with that. Or you can sack him as the head of the Climate Change Authority and move on.
And if you doubt. No, that's... but does he ever say, being an Australian, say, scientist and writer, what prompted him to do the research on, say, the North America?
Well, I think it's a bit like Alan said when he first went up to New Guinea, because his studies post-arts were in marsupial evolution. He noticed that there's glaciers in New Guinea and that they were retreating. So every time he went back, they were getting further and further away. When you're looking at some of the high mountains in New Guinea, as Alan said, he noticed that some of the species he was seeing were moving further and further up the mountain as the climate warmed. So whereas in his first visit, say, mosquitoes could only get up to 2,000 metres, then it was too cold, when he went back the next time, the height that the mosquitoes could operate at was gradually increasing. And he sort of noticed that that was changing the overall flora and fauna distribution.
Right.
As it has on the Australian mainland as well.
Yeah.
And being the inquisitive mind he said, why is it so?
Yes, exactly. Mm. And obviously decided to have a look at...
But there were other writers in the field, as we've said, but he's certainly become one of the preeminent ones since.
Yeah. And no, it's, I imagine it's because his work is quite accessible, as you know.
Oh, well, you know,
to the layperson.
Accessible in that context, also accessible in the context of, I think we've picked this book up from the Brower College toss out of library tomes, haven't we, Dennis?
Well, I got it at the Rotary book sale in Geelong West last
year.
There
you go. Yeah.
There you go. It's a good place to get one too.
It's the best place to pick your books up are at the op shop sales, because they are going out at fire sale prices.
I'll just look up the back to see how many people borrowed it when it was at Brower College. Yeah.
Now, The Weathermakers, you both read that. I remember, I think we were might have been travelling through Asia when you were reading that a few years ago, and... It seemed to have quite a profound effect, because that was early days, maybe 10 years ago, when it was published in 2003, and he was really writing about the impact the weather was having on, or the change in climate, I suppose, climate change, all those years ago, and I can remember you just quite taken by...
Yeah, well, was that in my yoga phase, was it?
It probably was.
He bent over backwards to sort of try and teach you that.
You mentioned David Suzuki before I came in, actually, and I didn't quite get the full commentary on that. But I guess everyone has champions no matter what genre you read, you'll have a champion of some sort, and you'll have Robichaud, you know, in the crime and fiction, and I guess in the science area, it was David Suzuki, and I used to read a lot of Suzuki stuff until I drifted away from Suzuki's point of view. I just thought it was too much about David Suzuki rather than about the issue. Now, that's just me. So, yep. You know, you've got to put that in context too, that you're reading, at your state of mind at any point in reading a book also dictates how you take away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the Flannery's book was, as you say, The Weathermakers was in front of us at the time and made a lot of sense. And I thought, you know, well, why not? I think that's, he's an Australian. I like what he's saying. Mm. He's not beating a drum here. He's just telling it for what it is. And if you want to listen to him, you can take a lot away from it. And that would be the genesis of why I was so attracted to what he was saying.
And he used to barrack for Melbourne.
Oh, I didn't know that, Dennis. Well, there you go. I didn't know that.
He's from Sandringham.
There's a good point. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Can I talk about terraforming now or later?
Oh, you might as well talk about that now.
Artificial or
people will be just hanging on
every word.
Every word. They would be stopped cooking tea, waiting to hear about terra firma.
Terraforming.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Terraforming is an idea where life has made Earth the place that we enjoy today. Mm. If you go back to early in Earth's history, it was a very hostile place with a completely different environment. No oxygen, a lot cooler than it is now, mostly methane in the atmosphere. And what the first forms of life were what's called chemosynthetic. They broke down some of the molecules that they were encountering on Earth and produced new ones. And so eventually oxygen became one of those. And over a period of a long, 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 long time, they changed the composition of Earth's atmosphere from methane-based chemicals into oxygen, which is very unusual in the solar system and in the wider galaxy, if you will, because oxygen is a very, very reactive gas, as everybody who's lit a fire or fought a fire would know. It can't wait to react with whatever's around it. And the concentrations of oxygen on Earth were made and are maintained by living things. And so terraforming is a process that's happened to Earth many times through its history. The various animals and plants that have lived here have changed the Earth very dramatically. It's just that the point he's trying to make is that we're terraforming it a little too quickly for all the other animals and plants that are trying to live here with us. And so the changes we're making are geologically incredibly quick, and it's having a sad effect on things like corals and the Great Barrier Reef. Mm. And probably we'd all like to stop that, or at least do what we could to make that go more slowly.
You would think.
You are listening to Dennis Flannery.
On 87.6 FM.
I've always wanted to go to New Guinea.
interesting for those people who read the conversation, I don't know whether you've picked up on this in the last couple of weeks, Dennis, that the commentary in the science journals is switched over to in the quest for finding the Goldilocks planets, that they're now looking much more closely at what you enunciated in relation to the way terraforming made what we have today and where we came from. And I think, you know, I don't know why we're looking for aliens, because I reckon we found them.
The irony of greenhouse, of course, 20 years. Without carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, Earth's temperature would be about minus 18. So terraforming produced greenhouse gases, if you will, that brought Earth's temperature up to, a balmy 12 on average, I think, average out Earth's temperature.
Yeah.
But the trouble is we're making a little too much of it, and so it's balmying up too much.
Yeah.
And now the one of the schools of thoughts is that the tectonic plate movement could be one of the biggest drivers of all of these processes.
Yes.
In the way that it actually makes these chemical reactions and brings up these new compounds, and we would not be the place we are today without these processes. And they are unable to find these Goldilocks planets that also have the the tectonic plate movement that we know happens here on Earth. It's fascinating once you get into it, I'm no scientist, and you don't have to be a scientist. You just need to read it
and have an inquiring mind.
Why is it so?
True.
No, that's good. And Flannery probably is. Well, he'd be at the forefront, I suppose, certainly in Australian literature, or scientific literature. But to me, his books aren't pushed as scientific literature as such. They're just out there as, well, I suppose he's got, as you said, he's got his agenda there, but they're there for anyone to read, like, in terms of you don't have to be a scientist.
Yeah, so his gift definitely is he's written plenty of scientific papers that you'd really struggle to get through, but he's been able to group those and transform them into something readable. And probably the main message we want to give is it's not preaching. It follows, in the case of the North American book, quite a well-set-out geological history of North America and is quite interesting to read in itself and tries to point out that Earth has always been a changeable place.
Yeah.
And that the challenge for us at the moment is to try and slow a few of those changes up.
Now, Dennis, tectonic plates.
Well, yes, we have to go back to this idea of a Goldilocks planet. And as everybody knows,
View of what that would be.
Goldilocks is really about the three bears when she's come up to taste the porridge, John. And it's not too hot, not too cold, but just right. And so around every star, there's what's called a Goldilocks zone where water will basically not be frozen, given that there's an atmosphere around to keep it a little bit balmy. So it's interesting in our own solar system. If we start out at Mars, there's only 1% of the atmosphere on Mars that there is on Earth. And so even though you get 200 kilometre an hour winds, they don't have anything like the force in them, say, that a cyclone does. Although if you've seen The Martian, of course, they can tip over a lander, apparently, and strand film stars on Mars.
Yeah. Or in a Hollywood lot. Because they never really went there, did they?
That's right.
No, I know. No, I read that in New Dawn in the newspaper 3 months ago.
But if you're at the Martian equator, say, I think sometimes the temperature can get up to around, say, 10 Celsius, but that would only be your feet. Your head would be frozen stiff because Mars doesn't sort of have an atmosphere to grab that heat and distribute it, if that makes any sense.
Not really, but...
Oh,
well, why the push to... Mars.
We're still doing the Goldilocks.
Oh, sorry.
Just hang on.
Yeah, all right.
So that's too cold. It's too cold because Mars has lost its atmosphere at some stage. It can't hold heat in anymore. All the water that was on Mars has evaporated away because the atmosphere provides the pressure to keep water liquid. Liquid water, astronomically being quite rare. There's lots and lots of ice and lots of vapor, but no liquid. If you come down to Earth, we've got a nice atmosphere. It's probably only thick enough, I think, once you go over 8 kilometres up, you start to die. But underneath that, it's keeping water liquid and it's all very good. Even the worst places on Earth aren't too bad to stand around in. Then if we move on to Venus, which isn't that much further into the sun than Earth, it has a runaway greenhouse effect. So once upon a time, Venus wasn't like it is now. But because it has too much carbon dioxide on it, the temperatures have ballooned up to 400 degrees Celsius and... it's hell. I mean, when I was little, I remember reading a comic where they thought there might be a big ocean on Venus with mermaids and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I recall that.
But
not true?
No, sadly.
Mm.
So anyway, that's the idea of the Goldilocks zone. Right. Is looking around for things that are in just the right zone to maybe harbour life.
As we know it.
As we know it, yes, John. Mm. And the way they do it is they've got a dedicated telescope out in space now that can detect planets going across their star.
Yeah, well, it's been in the news a fair bit, all these amazing photographs coming back. Is it...
This the Hubble?
Pluto?
No, not the Hubble. It's a dedicated one.
Oh, sorry.
Is it Pluto they're bringing... Pluto, there's been a lot of photographs of...
That was a different...
That was a
That was a space probe that flew past Pluto, going so quickly that... it's way out in the outer solar system now, but it's a telescope that orbits Earth and looks at other stars. And if the star has a bit of a wobble, like if you can remember when you had a little kitty, if you were spinning them round and round, you would wobble as you span them. And in a similar way, a star wobbles a little bit as its planets spin around it. And based on that wobble and the shadow that the planets leave on the stars as they cross it, this telescope can tell how big the planet is and how fast it's going.
Let's say all this is fascinating information, Dennis, but let's look at it from a literature side. Where do you read this, get this information from?
Basically, there's an Australian science magazine called Cosmos, which is written in a very approachable way, if you like that type of writing. That will keep you across major developments in science globally, but has a particularly Australian flavour because we do so much good science here. And again, the way it's written is to try and make it accessible to people who may not necessarily have done a degree in science. It's trying to sort of point out that science has a story to tell, and the story can be quite interesting.
Yep. So you subscribe to this magazine?
I do, or? Yes.
I know you used to be able to buy it, actually, in the news. So I don't know it's for general.
No, yeah, it's won quite a lot of awards internationally for telling science as a story.
Right. So obviously they've got some journalists there that can, a bit like Flannery, put across
Put across their message.
Information that is easy enough to read, I suppose, and absorb, or interesting.
Yeah, so we'll explain things in the news like they recently discovered gravity waves, which had been widely predicted but never detected, and will try and explain those in a way that people can understand and explain why that's so important and the way it may influence our lives. Point out things that relativity is real and that we couldn't have GPS without it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's important, don't I?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, if I just might point out that there is a web-based document or newsletter, I should say, called The Conversation, where you can get access to all this information that Dennis is talking about for free. The conversation relies on public donations to keep it going, and it's based on input from people, the very people that Dennis is talking about, and the likes of the Flannerys of the world and so forth. And it also puts the alternative point of view if that's ever presented. It's a vetted conversation by an arbiter, I suppose, so that there's no one can actually push an agenda.
Yeah,
it's just pure, cold, hard fact, but put in a way that the ordinary person can read. Yeah, the conversation. You just need to subscribe to it, as in your email, not financially.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's all sorts of interesting literature out there, readily available.
Yeah, well, that's
you
right.
Don't.
You can pay for it, you can get it free, or you can go to the op shop and pick it up.
And pick up next a Tim Flannery.
Exactly. And pick up a Tim Flannery for a dollar.
Oh, good value.
Mm. Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Now, let's just, on another subject, literature in general. Al, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading I just cannot remember the author's name. I'm terrible at this. If you put me on the spot, John Boy. But it's called The Lives of Others. And it's a book set in India around about the time of partition. And it's describing the struggle between the poor, the peasants, and how they were, you know, kept down by the middle class of India even at that time in 1948,
right? Yeah.
And then how the impact of separation or partition, if you want to call it that, or independence, had the impact that had on them at their level on the ground, because most of these things are large. They were just political chess pieces, you know, being moved around at the time back in the, if you can, you know, straight after the war sort of thing, and the Naxalites, I think they were called, which was a movement in India that was stirring up the peasantry, and great read, because it's written from both sides. It's written from the middle classes. He flips from chapter to chapter. It's a novel, by the way, but based on historical fact. Flips from the middle class view of how this was progressing to the peasants' view of it, looking back up, sort of saying, "Well, how we get a bowl of rice out of this?" You know,
right.
And interesting enough, it's not the East Pakistan as it became, which is now Bangladesh. So it's not the traditional right that you might get, which is now Pakistan.
Cool. Dan, when you're not reading scientific books.
I knew I'd get this. I'm reading The Green Mile, which is a book about an Irish family. It's sort of set in Ireland, but it's written in a very unusual way. There's four children in the family, and the book starts off with the family together when they're young, and then looks at each of the family members as they leave home and go into the world or emigrate, and the things that happen to them and the issues that they face in their lives. Then what happens is they all come back together because the mother decides to sell the family farm and they have to meet up and try and get on for Christmas. So I can just hear the crockery flying through the...
you can relate to that whole story.
Yes, I can relate to that, yeah. So it's very, very good, very well written.
And what was it called again?
The Green Mile.
Green Mile.
Green Road.
Cool. No, Green Mile was... isn't that a Stephen
That's
King?
That's a film. No, it's a Green Road. Sorry, I got it wrong.
Yeah. Green Road.
Yeah. Yeah. Green something. Green well, being Irish, it'd have to be Green right. something.
Yeah. Green Hills of Ireland. Yeah. I'm reading a Somerset Maugham of Human Bondage.
Gee.
Interesting, yeah.
Just interesting.
I don't know why it is. It's about a late 19th century child. He's only young. He's born with a club foot. His mother dies and he has to go into the English country with his uncle who's a vicar and he's a real prick and he's sort of bullied at school and he's good at art, but his uncle wants him to be, sons of vicars become vicars. And it ends up in Paris. He's just sort of been painting in Paris, the life of Paris around the Impressionists, and realised that he's not much good at it. So he's gone back to England to become a doctor. I'm about halfway through and he's describing how he learned to become a doctor in late 19th century England.
Sounds like his reversal autobiography.
Well, I don't know much about Somerset Maugham at all. But
he was trained from a wealthy family in England, trained as a doctor and went to Paris and
It does say on the back that he's almost autobiographical. Yeah.
Interesting. The three books that we're reading are all reflective. They're all past tense. They're all looking back. None of them are contemporary in the sense of...
What about Tim, mate? He's looking forward.
There you go. So if you would have to say, if you read Tim Flannery, you're into the future, and if you read novels described...
I wouldn't... I know of him, Somerset Maugham, but I sort of... It's a reasonably fat novel, and for some reason I thought it would be a bit stodgy, but I was thinking about it the other night. The subject matter is... pretty simple. There's nothing traumatic happening, but he's telling a good story of a kid with a deformity in that time, how he's bullied and how he's just sort of handled it in various ways, and he's shy and he's sort of just discovering women and stuff like this. And
so life mirroring art, art mirroring
life.
I think he's a tremendous writer. I read his short story collection.
You're saying that.
Had no expectations when I picked it up, but he's such a sparse writer and yet balances everything that he says so beautifully around such simple
and
ideas.
And his language is not dated. I
loved his language, that early 20th century English writing. I thought it was terrific.
He's written, I think, a couple from... I shouldn't be saying this without actually having the facts in front of me, but... He went to India somewhere like that.
Yes, he was India or something?
Was Ian Forster.
He visited all those places. Oh, he's quite wealthy. So he sort of moved around and he was, like in India, he was in the expat community and a lot of the short stories are about the empire really and just reading it. I mean, he was late empire. Was just fascinating the lives that those people could lead. So basically middle or lower middle class English people going to a place like India or any of the other English colonies and living this outrageous princely life that they could never, ever, ever possibly hope to achieve.
Just back at home. I'll have to, once I finish this, and have to try and hunt up a few more.
I'll get you the short stories there somewhere.
That'd be good.
I'll end it a cough, though, so I'll never see
them
again.
Oh, you'll never see that again. Yeah. I'm not a big short story fan, actually. I like a composition or a,
You like a bit of meat.
Well, the sports article in The Age and a novel. That's about me, I think.
Bloody Hawthorne supporters. No one else has read the sports pages.
No. Okay, that's about the book show for tonight. I hope you got some information as a listener from our ramblings on Tim Flannery's work. Thanks for coming in, Dennis.
Anton, the ads aren't working.
Anton, the ads aren't working, but it's all right. Alan, thank you for your contribution.
Thank you, John Boy, for exploring such an interesting subject. Well done.
Yeah, it was, as I said, a bit ad hoc, seeing Lee had to go and save the nation in Colac and vote, count the votes. Soon they had the day off yesterday.
That's right. The nation hangs in the balance, but we're having a day off.
We're having a Monday off. That's beautiful. All right, thanks for that. Closing comment.
Science is a story. Don't be afraid to dip your toe in the water.
It's true enough. Thank you, Dennis. If you can understand,
only
what
if
that
the water is doesn't freeze your head.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Like it does on Mars. Yeah, yeah. All right, night everyone. See you next week. I think Deb's in for the book show, and hopefully this will be up on a podcast in a couple of days.